Over the past several months, my conversations with colleagues in the Alzheimer's field have featured an unusual sentiment, optimism inflected with worry. Optimism because after years of failed studies and the disastrous accelerated approval of aducanumab, we're enjoying a less than 1 year-old streak of good news. The latest bright flash is the June 9 Food and Drug Administration hearing on the anti-amyloid antibody lecanemab, to be sold by Eisai as Leqembi. Full approval is almost a certainty. But here's my worry. In the months after the drugs are approved, news organizations will recount the sad stories of patients who received a prescription that was neither reasonable nor necessary. They were prescribed the drugs following sloppy diagnoses and went on to suffer risks that weren't properly mitigated. Skeptics will gesture to aducanumab and parade these stories out as further evidence that these anti-amyloid drugs don't work or are too risky and so a waste of Medicare resources. The problem isn't the drugs, it's the drugs in the system.
That was Jason Karlowish, a professor of medicine, medical ethics and health policy, and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. He's also co-director of the Penn Memory Center. He was reading from his recent first opinion essay on how to balance the risks and benefits of the new Alzheimer's drug lecanemab. After a quick break, I'll bring you our conversation about what makes Alzheimer's drugs particularly challenging to prescribe and to regulate.
I'm Jesse McQuarters, branded content editor for STAT. Recognizing the breadth and diversity of America's 53 million family caregivers, how can we better know and see these important unsung heroes? Lisa Wilson, head of caregiver advancement strategy and experience at United Healthcare, offers insights.
Family caregivers are a cornerstone of our health system, but it can be challenging to support them in the moments that matter. United Healthcare is breaking down the barriers to identifying and engaging caregivers. For example, we're making it easy for caregivers to establish necessary HIPAA permissions and encouraging self-identification. The more we know about this population, the more we see them, especially early on in their caregiving journey, the better support we can provide.
For more information, visit uhc.com/caregiving.
Welcome to the First Opinion Podcast. I'm Tori Bosch, editor of First Opinion. First Opinion is STAT's platform for interesting, illuminating, and provocative articles about the life sciences writ large, written by biotech insiders, healthcare workers, researchers, and others. Jason, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to be here, Tori.
I want to start with the basics because this is a pretty thorny issue in a lot of ways. So exactly how common is Alzheimer's and why don't we have any good treatment options up to this point?
Alzheimer's is definitely common, but exactly how common is it depends on how you measure it. Having said that, if you want to capture Alzheimer's as defined by you've got to have some signs and symptoms, some troubles with cognition impacting your daily life, we think there are somewhere between about 5 and 6 million people. If you want to define the disease biologically only, that number is bigger and it depends on how you want to define it. But we're talking about a total patient population of in the millions.
And up until this point, there haven't really been great treatment options. Why is that?
That's right. A mixed and varied history. I think the pre-biomarker era was an era where we were struggling with making a diagnosis that was a clinical diagnosis only. And then the anti-amyloid drugs began to be tested. This goes back a good 10 years. In the early days, we didn't require people to actually have amyloid. And so I think many of those studies were studying people who didn't necessarily even have Alzheimer's. Anyway, you're dealing with multiple challenges. Did they even have amyloid? Well, we finally got that testing done. What's the right dosing to get into the brain? What's the right duration of therapy, et cetera? Along the way, there was that big bump in the road that was known as aducanumab, which was really a failure of regulatory science and stands out distinctly for that. But I think when one looks back over the arc of history, you do see an incremental series of learnings from our failures, which have taken us now to where we are with the very promising results from the study of lecanemab and the very promising results, albeit from a press release, understandable for why, but we'll learn more soon, of donanemab.
And we're going to get into the biomarkers, into aducanumab, and all sorts of other things soon. But before we get into those details, I just wanted to ask, what would an effective Alzheimer's treatment mean for patients and their families? And how would you define an effective treatment?
Yeah, I mean, so sort of a treatment that clearly is a cure, meaning over time that no one gets sicker, things get nettlesome very quickly. Because unlike, say, treatments for other common diseases seen in older adults, heart attack, cancer, the way to measure benefit in this disease is very different. So in diseases like cancer, it's about living longer. The longer I can live, so be it, that's good. And so we measure survival, which means death, et cetera. Very easy to measure. In contrast, death, for example, survival, living longer with Alzheimer's has never been measured as a benefit of treatment because it's very contingent on something else, namely quality of mind. But, you know, mind is a very difficult construct to measure. And in the field of Alzheimer's, it's been a kind of dialogue of resistance and accommodation across many and multiple measures of cognition, function, measures that blend cognition and function, et cetera, such that what we have is a language which is, frankly, a bit opaque, certainly opaque across the communities of researchers, clinicians, patients, caregivers, and policymakers. Survival is easy. Everyone understands it. In this disease, though, the measures are far more opaque and not well understood across those communities.
And so the measure might be, you know, how long does somebody recognize someone or how much are they able to enjoy a day, right? I mean, what are the actual, like, metrics you might be using?
Right. I'm smiling because, you know, that's one of many dimensions that one could get at, you know, and does recognizing family members matter? I think it does. But that's the point. And even if we could agree on the measure, You're left not with the dichotomous 1-0 phenomena, but again, you're left with points along a scale that measures recognizability of family members. And so that just sort of haunts the field. I mean, the one measure I think that probably should emerge is, can we agree on this as being kind of meaningful? Patients and caregivers understand stage of Alzheimer's. I mean, I have patients and caregivers who come into my practice and say, I think she's about a stage one, you know, or I think he's kind of moved to the next stage. Because they go online and they read the seven stages. They read these materials prepared for by the various advocacy groups and the National Institute on Aging. And the studies do capture stage. In fact, you're admitted to the studies based on having either very mild or mild stage disease. That's an eligibility criteria of lecanemab. And they did capture, did you progress to the next stage of disease as one of the endpoints, albeit it was a secondary endpoint and the analysis is a bit dodgy, just kind of opaque to follow. I wish that was elevated because I think that would be the most transparent thing. After treatment of so much duration, what proportion of people are still at the stage they started out at versus advanced to the next stage? And I think many would agree that's an event that we can understand and explain, and out of which that benefit, you can then balance it against risks, you can balance it against the cost of the drug. Unfortunately, that hasn't risen as the primary endpoint for these studies, which is unfortunate, I think.
So now I want to get into lecanemab and what makes it such a game changer compared with what's come before it?
Well, what's before it are drugs that manipulate neurotransmitters. No complaint about those drugs, and they certainly show a fairly immediate effect upon improving patients' cognitive and functional symptoms within a few weeks. This drug is different, though. This drug goes after one of at least two pathologies that we think is part of the causal cascade that leads to neurodegeneration, that leads to cell death. That's the pathology called amyloid, beta amyloid, to be more precise. And lecanemab is an anti-amyloid antibody. And the results of the study were very compelling. What you saw was consistent changes across multiple of those various opaque measures of cognition and function that all favored drug being more effective, greater than chance than placebo. And in addition, which I think was very exciting as a physician and as a scientist and researcher and writer, is to see effects on the biomarkers, not just amyloid, but markers of tau, markers of neurodegeneration. And what it suggests, and I think this is still something that needs more study, but it suggests that we have manipulated the pathophysiology of the disease, and in doing so, affected the rate of clinical decline. We don't have another drug out there for this disease like that. That is big news.
And big news is certainly welcome in this space, as you've described.
It is. I've been working in the space since 1997. And, you know, my practice in terms of my ability to use a biomedical model of treatment has not dramatically changed in all that time. And it's going to change very soon and very rapidly. And that's encouraging.
And so we're recording this on Tuesday, June 27th. And I believe that approval for the drug is expected to come in by July 6th. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that FDA has a sort of deadline then. And, you know, I think the safe assumption based on the tone of the advisory hearing and the vote, quite frankly, which was unanimous, is in support that the drug is beneficial, is that FDA will give it full approval. Right now it has that quirky conditional approval, which is from that bad precedent set by that mess that was aducanumab.
And I want to talk about that mess in a minute. But first, you know, you mentioned that this is going to really change the way you practice. So
yeah.
On a practical level, how is this going to change your day-to-day and your patient's experience?
Well, now we're going to start talking about, for people within the range of patients who might be eligible for this, with very mild to mild stage clinical Alzheimer's disease. Now we're talking about measuring one of the biomarkers of the disease. There's also some other interesting measures that we're going to talk about too, some of the genetics of the disease. And we're going to start talking about some of the sort of common co-pathologies seen in the disease, namely cerebral amyloid angiopathy, those little tiny microscopic bleeds. And then we're going to have to start talking about, in a way we haven't talked about ever, unlike my colleagues in oncology, a drug with very measured benefits and also very measured risks and uncertainties. That's a very novel conversation to have in the field. It's one that I'm looking forward to, but we haven't talked like that with our patients ever, really, as I gesture to my colleagues in oncology, because, I mean, that's the sort of, you know, typical conversations unfolding a few floors down from me at the Penn Memory Center, for example.
And what are those risks exactly?
Yeah, so a very well-described risk with the anti-amyloid antibodies seen across all the antibodies in various, some more than others, but let's focus on this one, is a risk of microscopic bleeds in the brain, microscopic hemorrhages, and microscopic areas of swelling or microscopic edema. And they are well described. They're far more they're more common than if you're on placebo. And they're also more common if you have a certain genetic makeup. And they are the principal risk of this drug.
We should note that you've been a site co-investigator on clinical trials sponsored by Biogen, Eisai, and Lilly. And so what has that work been like exactly, and how do you think it's affected the way you're approaching this pending approval?
Well, it gives us some experience with the drugs, and that experience says that these are technically complicated drugs. The criteria to decide someone's eligible, meaning do they fit that window of MCI or mild stage dementia, the measurement of the biomarker of amyloid and its interpretation. There's interpretation needed on the scans. And then the read of the MRI for microscopic hemorrhages. It's not straightforward. You got to see them, number one, but also there's subtleties of interpretation. And over the course of getting the treatment, then the experience of the patient, the symptoms of the microscopic bleeds and swelling are often very nonspecific things like headache, dizziness, symptoms that, frankly, for all of us are fairly nonspecific and as one gets older, oftentimes common. And so the judgment is whether, given who someone is, do they need to come in and get a scan or not? The protocol that we used, that was used for these drugs, had a very scheduled set of MRIs done as well, because the side effects are likely to occur early in the first few months of treatment. So it's a doable drug to prescribe and give. That we did it, and many other sites did it. There's nothing special about what we're doing at the Penn Memory Center, but it's a bit of work, and it requires a level of, I think, knowledge and expertise that is just that, a level of knowledge and expertise over and above the typical person in the fields of geriatrics, psychiatry, or neurology. It requires, quite frankly, an Alzheimer's expert.
One question I have is how much looking for these nonspecific symptoms is particularly challenging, perhaps, in patients with early stage Alzheimer's? I mean, are they generally at a stage at which it's still fairly accessible for them to articulate those side effects or those symptoms they're experiencing? Or is it getting a little bit challenging at that point?
In general, they are. Yeah, I think patients at that stage can tell you they're not feeling well, et cetera. I think, though, it does emphasize, I think implicit in your question is the study required, as is typical for Alzheimer's clinical trials, nothing special here, the role of a study partner. Typically, the study partner's role is to help fill out some of those measurements, those endpoints, reports of function. In particular, we rely on an informant, which otherwise I think is more appropriately called a caregiver. But I think with these drugs, we see an additional role for that caregiver, namely watching out over the person who may not quite report what's going on, as all of us might not. I mean, we're wonderful symptom deniers, all of us, and getting them in if they need to come in, to get the scans and to get the every other week infusion that the drug requires. So this is a drug that, unlike, implicit in Alzheimer's really is wrapped up in the life of at least one other person, but taking this drug really requires a caregiver to get in and get the infusions, to monitor response during it, and in particular in the weeks to follow. And if needed, well, not if needed, necessary, is coming in for the scheduled MRIs, let alone an MRI off schedule because of something wrong. So you really need to involve someone else. I'm not bothered by that. That's just a reality of this disease.
Right. And it also gets to your big point in the article, which is that the system is just really not sort of set up for this kind of drug. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I hope I've made clear that the workup here is not just get an amyloid test and then let's get a vein that we can cannulate. I mean, the amyloid test comes after an assessment of whether someone even has cognitive impairment within the ranges that have been shown there. And there's real errors on both sides of either underdiagnosis, missing what actually is impairment and dismissing it as, quote, normal aging. And the other side of it is, admitting someone who actually is a little bit far beyond the stage of the disease. And that workup takes a good hour at least of history and cognitive testing. It's not just, let's do a quick checklist of symptoms, et cetera. And then there's, of course, the biomarker test, which has its need for interpretation. Amyloid scans, for example, are oftentimes quite evident whether they're positive or negative, but there's an intermediate read there that often requires adjudication. There's the MRI, et cetera. So, I mean, I'm not going to repeat the whole workup. My point is that the construct of an Alzheimer's expert is right now one that is really self-declared. Any physician could say they're an Alzheimer's expert. Any physician with a decent infusion center that perhaps works in neuroinflammatory diseases could, for example, say, well, you know what, I think I want to get into the Alzheimer's space now, and she could do that. Just because one trains in geriatrics, neurology, or psychiatry does not mean one is an Alzheimer's expert. It does not. And I say that as a geriatrician who needed some additional training in my years after my fellowship to be able to do what I do. And I think most neurologists and psychiatrists would certainly admit the same thing as well. So, there are very few of us, and this drug is complicated. And I think there's a legitimate worry, as to who are the prescribers that are going to be taking up this drug. Will they be experts capable of prescribing it or not? And we have no ex ante criteria for that set forth in our system, and then the settings where these drugs will be used. I think you can sense that it requires more than just a doctor with a prescription pad. It requires obviously a lot of ancillary support and whatnot to be able to make sure a patient's adequately diagnosed, followed up, monitored, etc. Our memory center is gearing up to do this. And all my colleagues at their centers are doing the same. But memory centers are not common. We're typically at academic medical centers, oftentimes lined up with a research enterprise, et cetera. So there's a real dearth in the system here of the essential resources to prescribe a drug with some complicated risks and complexities of delivery.
Yeah, I mean, and so imagine somebody lives in a rural area, is many hours from an academic center by drive or by flight. Is this something that there's a risk of, say, primary care physicians trying to prescribe it? I mean, or would most primary care physicians say, I just don't have the capability to do this?
I would think most primary care physicians in surveys of primary care physicians say that they feel woefully underskilled in working up dementia, woefully under-resourced in a referral base for patients that they want a referral on. I'd be surprised if a primary care physician took up this drug. I really would.
Which seems then really frustrating for a patient or family who don't have access to a memory center.
It is. Look, we've had decades to work on this problem as a country. I mean, in France, over 15 years ago, the French government said we need to create a network of memory centers throughout France with central hub and spoke models for diagnosis and delivery of care. One of the decisions they made as a country was we're not going to pay for donepezil, so we can use those funds instead to help support this network. Other countries have similarly stepped up and said we need to create a network. We could have done this. And so the complaints that, you know, any efforts to sort of assure that this drug is delivered to the right patient at the right time are barriers to access to therapy, I kind of laugh and say, those barriers have been there for over three decades. I don't understand why all of a sudden this drug suddenly has us woke up to this problem and why we would say, let's put this drug out there, you know, going from 0 to 60 miles an hour on a roadway that's not even, we're not even sure you can drive at 40 miles an hour on. It just seems reckless. And I think this drug should be out there. It should be prescribed. But it should be done in a way that we learn from what we're doing and do it in a way that assures that we've mitigated the risks and made sure that it's being done in a way that's reasonable and necessary. And this is a sentiment that is very much shared amongst my colleagues.
Yeah, I bet. You know, I think if I remember correctly, the vast majority of Alzheimer's patients are on Medicare. So can you talk a little bit about the role of Medicare, of CMS in both prescribing and then also maybe tackling some of these broader problems around the system?
Yeah, I mean, the events in the Alzheimer's drug development of the last 2 years have been one of the oddest events. And I'm going back to the mess that was aducanumab, where really FDA just dropped the ball.
Yeah, so I've been meaning to get to that. Can you give us the 30-second synopsis of what went wrong there exactly?
Basically, it was a failure of regulatory science. I mean, FDA, based on the results of the congressional investigation, I selected individuals at FDA seem to have kind of gotten co-opted into a kind of a regulatory co-op by industry and engaged in a relationship with Biogen that resulted in taking a data set that was at best good preliminary data for the next necessary well-designed phase three trial to finally establish whether the drug worked. The drug very well may work. It's just the data they had didn't show it. Anyway, FDA chose quite opposite. They granted it conditional approval, otherwise known as accelerated approval, with a label that was so broad you could give the drug to anyone. They had actually revised that label a few weeks later. It was so outrageous. And the rest is just kind of a mess of that. So it left CMS with this sort of, you know, usually when FDA approves a drug, CMS payment follows as day follows night. You know, pick your metaphor of sort of natural phenomenon in the world. That didn't happen here because I think CMS was handed a drug that they didn't have any evidence really that it worked. It was quite risky, et cetera. So anyway, what's my point? They said, look, we're going to require this drug to be studied with a rarely used mechanism that they have called coverage with evidence development, which effectively meant if you're going to get the drug, you need to be in a clinical trial, by the way, that criteria. CMS has since then said, look, if there's phase three data, what we'd like to see is people enrolled in a registry to better understand the drug's risks and benefits. And, you know, I can't read the mind of CMS, but as I reflected on these drugs in the system, again, the problem isn't the drugs per se, it's the drugs in the system. And CMS has to care about the system when they put these drugs out there. They're an insurer. And I think that their requirement for registry in principle makes sense because I think they recognize, again, I can't read their mind, but I agree with them. In principle, a registry would be one way, but unfortunately not the only way to assure that these drugs are prescribed in a way that's reasonable and necessary. The benefit of a registry, to wrap up, is we're going to know who's on the drugs, what the criteria were that got them on the drugs, and get some data from their medical record about how they're doing, particularly in light of the risks, the relationship to APOE genotype, the relationship to anticoagulant and blood thinning medications. And so we can learn more about the risks of the drug. So I think that registry idea is necessary, but not sufficient to assure these drugs are used well.
I should note, too, for listeners that if you're interested in hearing more of Jason Karlowish's perspective on aducanumab, which I will never pronounce correctly, please listen to a previous episode of the First Opinion podcast with host emeritus Pat Skerritt, which is really fascinating. So, all right, so the registry is a useful tool, not sufficient enough. What, and as you've noticed as well, we don't have enough doctors, we don't have the memory center system. What else do you think the system needs to be able to, you know, really take advantage, not just of lecanemab, but, you know, other drugs that might be coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, like donanemab, for example. Well, I mean, there are some technological fixes, which if we could get going, could really kind of address a lot of the challenges. Telemedicine, which we have all unfortunately experienced over the last 2 years, is a way to get access to clinicians. Remote monitoring of cognition and function using a variety of passive devices really shows great promise to sort of get the real-world data you need about how someone's doing. Blood-based biomarkers are incredibly promising ways to identify the presence of Alzheimer's biomarkers in a way that is far more convenient, certainly, and efficient, and likely less costly than the imaging tests. The problem is getting those scaled up in our current system. It's a big engineering hurdle. It's a bit like a moon launch. You know, if you want to invest in that engineering problem, you could probably get things going quicker. There are some regulatory issues too. You know, telemedicine right now is back to being state-based only, which is bizarre. You know, we have this sort of state-based medical licensure system, which comes out of the 19th century. You know, those all just need to be addressed. But I think one solution that needs to be put on the table that FDA can do and do right now is to embed these drugs in a risk evaluation and mitigation system, namely a REMS. They've done about 300 of these since about 2013. So they have experience in setting the REMSs up. And I think that they offer a way to address the specific challenges of this drug in the system to assure that the prescriptions mitigate the risks and they are given to people in a way that we think is reasonable and necessary and that we're learning. You know, one theme in that advisory board meeting that occurred just a few weeks ago over lecanemab was a constant repetition of the need for real-world data. And real-world data means data from a registry. But again, as I say, it's not just a registry that a REMS would have.
Yeah, and what's the argument against using a REMS? You know, when you explain it here and in your first opinion piece, it feels like obviously a really great idea. Why is it not something that the FDA has already spoken publicly about?
You know, I've reflected on that, and I think it might be the name. because first of all, never mind REMS, you know, evoking a stage of sleep. But you know, risk evaluation and mitigation conveys the notion of, ooh, it's a risky drug. Well, you know, and if I owned a drug, you know, I think I would probably be a little reluctant to have it be called a risky drug. You know, and yet it, again, it's not the drug, it's the drug in the system. It's a risky drug. These are risky drugs. And, you know, we don't know how they'll behave in people who have four or more microhemorrhages, which is a particular exclusion criteria in the study. We don't have enough data about how this drug will behave in people on blood thinners and anticoagulants. There were some in the study, individuals, but those numbers are small. And we all know there's a wide confidence around those estimates. There's enough things there. I listened to it. I said, you know, they really need to go just beyond writing a label and set up a system that they've done for other drugs that get complex and have ways to mitigate the risks. And again, that's a REMS. But again, I, as you asked, I think the problem with a REMS is the name. And if it was called something differently, I don't know, you know, Peaches, to quote our prior president, call it Peaches. You know, but it takes someone like that to understand the power of words and names.
You know, what advice would you offer to individual clinicians who are sort of thinking they're maybe not exactly in the same space as you are, but feel as though they want to learn more about the drug and how they can or cannot prescribe it, assuming it's approved? What advice would you offer them?
Well, Dr. Karlowish's dream of reason would be that part of the FDA REMS would include a physician training module for physicians to learn the key things they need to learn and then self-assess their comfort with the drug. I mean, I think a starting point is, are you a clinician who's comfortable working up older adults with cognitive complaints and delivering to them a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, not dementia, not terribly sure, could be normal aging, could be, but if you're comfortable saying Alzheimer's disease with confidence, then the next step is, are you comfortable with this drug? And again, my dream of reason would be an educational module that would assure you that you understand some of these key points that we've been talking about. But that's Karlowish's dream of reason in a world that seems increasingly less reasonable sometimes.
Now, my final question is, so let's say it's a year from now. It is late June, early July 2024. Do you think the way that you're practicing medicine is going to be different because of looking at that?
Yeah, I mean, there is. Number one, we'll be having many more conversations about biology, biomarkers, side effects, results of scans. I look forward to those things, but gosh, I hope they don't crowd out the other important conversations that patients and families want to have about finding meaning and purpose and the struggles that they have in perceiving the mind and the other person and understanding what it's like to be Joe or Jim or Judy who has Alzheimer's disease and asking the same questions of Joe, John, Jim, or Judy, et cetera, of what it's like. So I do have a slight worry that, you know, the presence of these drugs will crowd out some of the important conversations we need to have. Again, a lot of that's a resource issue. You know, it's just about having the time to take care of patients. And in biomedicine, you know, where the money is drives what you do. And once you see this business model of these drugs, they're going to drive a lot of behavior. And I worry how that will crowd out some of the other very important conversations we need to have with patients and family members. It's going to be a different world driven by this biomedical model, which, again, I'm happy to be part of. But I really would like it to roll out in a way that still respects that this is a disease of the mind that involves other people who themselves are affected by the disease. And if we lose that, I worry about the quality of care we're going to deliver to patients and their family members.
Jason Karlowish, thank you so much for joining me for this. It's been fascinating.
You're welcome, Tori. Thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to the First Opinion podcast. It's produced by Teresa Gaffney. Alyssa Ambrose is the senior producer, and Rick Burke is the executive producer. I would love to hear from more listeners, so please email me. Let me know which First Opinion contributors you'd like to hear on the show or what topics the podcast and the column should take on. You can email me at first.opinion@statnews.com. And if you have a minute, yes, I'm asking you again, please leave a review or rating on whatever platform you use to get your podcasts. Until next time, I'm Tori Bosch, and remember, please don't keep your opinions to yourself.